This was a pleasure having Mike as a student many years ago. It's my first time at the Perimeter Institute. It looks a fine place. Thank you for turning up. I fear you won't find what you expect in this talk because I made it in the... I don't understand anything. I'm an elementary guy. Maybe you'll understand what I say. I probably won't understand what you say. So let's start at the beginning. If you understand curls, divs, and grads, which I suspect I'm allowed to assume here, then away from the sources of a static electromagnetic field, you get div equals naught and curl equals naught, curl b equals naught and div b equals naught. So you can write E plus IB, this is square root of minus 1, is minus grad psi, where del squared psi equals naught. Well, I'm interested in simple things. So what is the simplest solution you can think about of del squared psi equals naught, which is complex? Anybody like to suggest a simple solution? Constant? People do suggest that. It's a bit dull, don't you think? next suggestion? Yeah? Yes, a two-dimensional holomorphic function would do. That's fairly general, so general that it wouldn't tell me very much. But a plane wave, that's, well, that doesn't work because it's what this is three-dimensional del squared psi equals naught. So we haven't got any dBdt's in there. But what I thought somebody would say was, thank you. Yeah, that, 1 over r. Well, q over r. Now, if we made q complex to make it complex, that wouldn't be very good because it would introduce a magnetic monopole. And that would disobey time reversal. It would disobey parity. And it's not very nice to make q. But if I move the origin... you don't mind me moving the origin, do you? And you get this thing. You can't take the square root because these are vectors. You get this thing. And as I've said, if you make Q complex, we don't like it. But you could make B complex. And if you made B general complex, you can shift the origin. So it's just the imaginary part that's interesting. And then you get the field of a charge at an imaginary point. Okay, well, we'll take this vector A to be naught, naught A. And of course, I should make the point that making B complex, this thing still obeys del squared psi equals naught. I mean, it doesn't care what whether B is real or imaginary. And so we then get this thing, and we can write R as x, y, z, and R squared and mu is cos theta, where that's the angle between little r and z. And then this is our potential when we write it out in full. And you can write that this way, if you like Lejeune polynomials. It's just the normal Lejeune polynomial expansion. And you then get E plus IB is this thing, and it's that thing, and it's magnetic dipole. You'll see that if you look up here, you'll see that all the odd moments are magnetic because they all start with an I, and all the even moments are electric. And if you look on the plane z equals naught, the argument of this third, which is that thing, becomes just r squared minus a squared because this term is zero, this is the capital R squared, and so it's r squared minus a squared, which is real. The third itself is then pure imaginary inside R equals A, because this is negative, and outside R equals A, it's real. And if you then go back, you can look at what the fields are on Z equals naught very nicely using that behavior. And you'll see that if we go to Z equals naught and we look at the potential, which is not here but up there, you find that that potential on Z equals naught is just this, and we've decided that this R is less than A, so the potential is actually zero. The electrical potential is actually zero, because this is pure imaginary with R less than A. This means that whatever we've got in this strange solution is earthed. Its actual electrical potential is zero. So, let's go on. Any square root of a complex number, well, any square root involves a sign ambiguity, and you put that sign change, we need to put that sign change. Well, if I went back, you would see that if I put a sign change on this square root that's involved here, if I put a sign change on that, then the electric and magnetic fields would both reverse in sign. So if I put the place where I'm going to change the sign of this square root, if I put those places in a place where B goes through the surface on which I change the sign of the square root, then I'll be generating magnetic monopoles. And we think they're bad. So we better put the change of sign on a surface of that follows the magnetic field so that there's no magnetic monopoles generated by our statement of where we're going to put the cut. And the fields change sign. If we put the sign change on the disk inside R equals A, then the fields change sign there, but no B, there's no B across the disk if you work out things, so there's no magnetic monopoles. And then we have a little cut disk. Outside the disk, the magnetic field is everywhere downwards if we went back. And then slightly odd question, there's no magnetic field inside the disk. The magnetic field outside the disk is downwards. Magnetic field lines don't end, do they? So we've got to get the magnetic field back up. This is all the properties of this simplest possible field. And this is a drawing of the field. This is the E field. It looks like this. And the B field looks like this. On the upper side of the disk, E is this, and it reverses, of course, on the lower side. And from that statement, you can, of course, find out what the total charge is, because this gives you the charge density on the disk. You get a very surprising answer. If Q, little q is positive, then this thing, well, this thing as a whole, is bigger than 1. And so when you take 1 from it, it's still a positive thing inside this bracket. And so the charge density, or the total charge, in less than some radius r, inside r equals a, the total charge is actually the wrong sign. It's of the opposite sign of the total charge outside R equals A. For R greater than A, when you work those things out again, you find the total charge is just Q. And this is a very surprising result, because this charge, the total charge within a sphere, any sphere like this, or like that, I suppose it's in the E field that you want it. You see that these arrows are pointing in from both sides, showing that the charge there is negative. And the total charge within any sphere around here, it's all on the disk, of course, that total charge diverges. The total charge diverges as you approach R equals A. And it diverges in the wrong direction. It diverges towards minus infinity when you know that the total charge on this disk is Q. You may say this is a very silly solution I've given you, but it's the simplest one I could get. All the magnetic field lines, when you work out the solution to that problem I asked of you of how the magnetic field lines got back up, it turns out that all the magnetic field lines go through the very edge of the disk. So they are all down on the outside of the disk, and they all come up through the edge point of the disk. It's very singular there. It's very singular everywhere, everywhere at close to this edge of the disk. And that was where we found the singularity in the original thing. That's a reasonable question, given what we've had before. Can we make anything remotely like this? Because this was a very simple potential. And I'm going to leave that question now and talk briefly about what was known about the electron when I was at school, which was a long time ago. When I was at school, the electron's mass, if the electron's mass is electrical, then you had to make a radius, which was this. And this gives a radius of this size, which turns out to be this. And these numbers, of course, have been much improved since I was at school. But it was all about the same. But quantum theory comes in first at a much larger radius, the Compton wavelength of the electron. And this is you can see it's more than 100 times larger than that value. And so what I was taught was only a small fraction of the electron's mass is in the field outside that, and that is quite true. And therefore, only a small fraction of the electron's mass is electromagnetic, and all the rest is in some sense due to something else. The ratio of these two numbers is, in practice, half the fine structure constant. And quantum electrodynamics, if you look at the subject from a very far away, which is the only way I know how to look at it, already has H or H crossed in it as a fundamental number, and it has the velocity of light in it, even in Maxwell's theory. And I regard it as perhaps the greatest failure of this theory. We'll come to one of its greatest achievements in a moment. But I regard it as one of the greatest failure of this theory as to why charge comes in this unit, which is now known rather accurately. You know, have you really got a decent theory as to why the charge comes in units like that? I think the answer is no when I look at what people do. And any decent theory ought to predict simple things like that. And at present, we haven't got a decent answer to that subject. The electron, even in my day, the electron had a spin. So it's got a magnetic moment, which is very near one Bohr magneton. And more exactly, it's this number. One of the greatest triumphs of quantum electrodynamics was to explain this number that far, which is a very remarkable fact that you can get all those numbers straight out of very tedious calculations in quantum electrodynamics. It's not really worth going further because more complicated things start coming in there to do with the heavier particles, etc., virtually, and therefore people have sort of stopped about that place. The ratio of the magnetic dipole of a body to its angular momentum is called the gyromagnetic ratio. There was a move within NMR people to call it the magnetogyric ratio, because that's what it is. That is, the magnetism is on top and the gyration is below, whereas everybody calls it the gyromagnetic ratio. And unfortunately, these people have not won the battle, and it's still called the gyromagnetic ratio. And that's the way it is. And for a classical charge in orbit, this G factor is 1, and the G factor for an electron is approximately 2. One of the questions that I think I was interested in is, can a G factor of 2 for the electron occur classically? Now, as you know, in 1963, Kerr found the solution for a spinning black hole by essentially finding a mistake in a paper by Newman that he was given to referee, and then following up the consequences of that mistake, Kerr found his solution. And in 1965, Newman and his class, because he set this, I don't know to how many, but I think 5 members of the class on the paper, found the generalization of Kerr's metric for a spinning charged black hole, which has both angular momentum and magnetic moment. And then 3 years later, Brandon Carter, who was a student when I was a young lecturer in Cambridge, he and Stephen Hawking shared offices, and he pointed out that all these metrics, Kerr-Newman metrics, had G equals 2, which is the same as Dirac's electron. That is not with that great quantum electrodynamic correction, but the G equals 2, the same as Dirac's electron. And so an interesting question is, here is a totally classical physics, if you count relativity as classical physics. Here is...
Sorry, can I ask a question?
Please.
If you have a spherical shell,
yeah,
rotates around its axis passing through its center,
yeah,
what's the geomagnetic ratio does it have?
I will tell you that in just a moment. I have that as an example in just a moment. It's a very interesting question, because it has a lot of complication in it if you look at it properly, unlike what is done in Jackson, which is to look at it sort of properly. How can this come about in classical physics, and is this right? Well, because in an electron it is absolutely clear that gravity is unimportant. One of the ways of dealing with that is to say, all right, I've got a beautiful solution in the Kerr-Newman metric, which is a complicated thing in general relativity, but if I put G equals naught, Newton's constant of gravity equals naught, to say that I'm interested in this on such small scales that the gravity is just unimportant, then space-time must become flat, because there isn't any gravity, so space-time must become flat. And actually, the Boyle-Lindquist coordinates in which you normally give these things become oblate spheroidal coordinates in Minkowski space. And Minkowski space being just ordinary flat space. Now, oblate spheroidal coordinates, if you take R in oblate spheroidal coordinates, the thing that people call R, it's actually equal to naught on a disk. So R is not R, which is a round thing. So when people start drawing R equals M or something like that for black holes, maybe R equals 2m, or R equals 2m modified by rotation q and charge. When they draw those things, normally it's drawn wrongly. Inside the ergosphere, you normally see an ergosphere drawn elliptical and then a spherical thing drawn in there. That's wrong, because if you put g equals naught, you find that those coordinates are themselves flat. So it ought to be an elliptical thing that is the surface of a rotating black hole, and another even more elliptical thing that's the surface of the ergosphere. Anyway, that's just a comment. The space-time must become flat, the coordinates become a Blaise spheroidal coordinates in Minkowski space. Of course, the charge and its electric field remain as they were, because they don't involve capital G. And so the electric current also remains as it was. And why I've been worrying you about the simplest possible field is that last comment, that in practice, when you do this to a Kerr-Newman metric, the field becomes precisely that field that we were talking about. I don't know if you want to see it again now that it's got another sort of way of driving it, which is, of course, much more complicated than the one that we started with. But it becomes precisely this field. And it's got this rather strange behavior at R equals A, and it's got a singular point there. And that's not too surprising, because when we put G equals naught, you're essentially going to a charged Kerr metric with no mass, and therefore, you're basically saying that A is greater than M. And so the singularity is exposed, unlike what it is in the normal Kerr metrics. So it's got an exposed singularity rather than one within a black hole. Well, this particular solution has a lot of magical behavior to me. Carter showed that both the relativistic Hamilton-Jacobi equation and the Schrödinger equation separate in the Kerr-Newman metric. Tucholsky showed that the zero-mass spinner-half Dirac equation separates. And then Chandrasekhar and Page showed that the massive Dirac equation does too. So all these equations, and separability is a difficult thing to get in a wave equation, all these equations have this inherit this property from this work of that's been done in curved space. The flat
space. Sorry, separate angles separately from R?
Yeah, both angles and R. You've got a full separation of the equations in the sense that you can get it to ordinary differential equations. Fairly nasty ones coupled through the eigenvalues and things like that, but that happens normally in the Blaise spheroidal coordinates. But all these equations do separate. And in fact, I set Jonathan Gehr some years ago the problem of working out not just separating the equations, which had been done before, but actually working out what the eigenvalues of an electron in the field of one of these things was. There is some interest in that. But one of the things that he showed, which had actually been shown before, we found later, as a result of work of Tiomnos, that if you go, you can always go to a velocity. If you have an electric and magnetic field, you can choose a velocity which is such that the E and the B are parallel. And the velocity that makes the E and the B parallel is actually given by this formula, which you will find in Landau and Lifshitz. And the transformed fields, E dashed and B dashed, when you go to this velocity, are then parallel. And what Gehr showed, and Tiomno showed before him, was that these directions of the electric and magnetic field in the transformed space were normal to the spheroids conformal, confocal to the disk. So if you have a disk, there are a set of spheroids that grow bigger and bigger and rounder, which are confocal to the little disk. And those spheroids, and furthermore, this velocity field that you got out of here was actually uniform rotation on each of these spheroids. So it wasn't the inner spheroids are rotating faster than the outer spheroids, etc. But the different spheroids, this velocity which makes the field, the fields parallel, they're parallel and perpendicular to the spheroids that they rotate. But if you work out the total electric field energy in that field, or the total magnetic field energy in the field, or the total angular momentum in the field, all of them diverge, and essentially at this ring singularity at the very edge. And not just the local field strengths, but the actual total angular momentum and total energies all diverge at that exposed singularity. This G equals 2 property, is it a property of general relativity? Well, it does hold for these black holes, and it holds for all highly relativistic bodies, but you can claim that that's not too surprising, because if they're highly relativistic, they're nearly at a black hole, and it holds for the black hole, so then it's not too surprising that it holds for all highly relativistic bodies. However, it also holds for conformist stationary metrics. Now, I better explain what conformist stationary metrics are, because they are in the textbooks, but you probably haven't met conformist stationary metrics. So I'll start by describing conformist static metrics, which are correctly described in the textbooks, whereas conformist stationary metrics are incorrectly described in the textbooks. Conformist static metrics are the metrics you get by taking any distribution of matter you like. And to every element of matter, you give a charge which is such that the gravity it produces on any other bit of matter is precisely cancelled by the electrostatic force between the two. So it's a very weak charge that you give to everything. And you give it to everything, and then you can make you can find a general relativistic solution in the shape of an elephant. And you just put it there. If you kicked the elephant, it would fall to bits. But you could make a solution that was exact, static, and in the shape of an elephant. Somebody whose name has gone from me suddenly, but anyway, one of these clever people in general relativity found a way of generalizing this to stationary metrics, that is, metrics in which the matter was moving. And what he managed to do was to find a general way of solving for the metric outside the matter, and that is absolutely correct. However, in the exact solutions book, you'll find it stated that these solutions are solutions in which all the forces are balanced inside the matter, and it's the external solution of such a thing. And this is incorrect. What has been done is to find solutions in which the electromagnetic forces are exactly cancelled the Coriolis forces of the motions inside the matter. This leaves the centrifugal forces unbalanced. And in practice, you have to put in Hoop stresses to keep everything correct if you want to look at conformist stationary metrics. Just to complicate things, when we were the first people, I think, to give an Katz, Beechak, and myself, Well, I think the first people to give a particular solution for a solution which included the internal metric, and just to complicate matters, we used the wrong definition of what a gyromagnetic ratio was and stated that the gyromagnetic ratio of these was 1. That was because we used the wrong definition. Unfortunately, we should have said it's always 2. And it is always 2. We did correct that, but you know, nobody reads the corrections. So, well, this is what I'm now going to talk about. I have about 30 minutes. Yeah, that's lots of time. I thought I had lots of time, but I looked at my watch and it didn't seem to be telling me what I thought it. Yes, I started at 11. Yes, that's right. Okay. Well, next thing I'm going to do is, can we devise a non-singular magic field? And I've looked at 2 ways of doing this. And I meant to look in much greater detail at this earlier work by Tiomno. He did a different thing than me. He chose a rather strange interior, which is sort of what he called perfect ferromagnetism. And he put inside one of these rotating spheroids, he put a material which was not only a perfect conductor, but was also a perfect ferromagnet. And as a result, he got an internal a field which he made to exactly fit the external field of the magic field. I did a slightly different thing and looked at first charge conducting spheres, which has a relation to the question that came from the back, and then I looked also at charge conducting disks. And instead of taking small speeds, I looked at these with velocities up to c. So before we do that, I'd like to talk about this case, which is the case solved in Jackson. For a static conducting sphere, surface charge is uniform and it resides just on the surface of the sphere. In steady rotation, the electrical resistance ensures that the charge moves with the sphere. And then Jackson rotates a spherical shell of uniform surface charge density and gets this magnetic field, which is uniform within the sphere and is purely dipolar on the outside. And I'm afraid I've not on this talk put down the gyromagnetic ratio, but you can get it quite easily from the sort of things that I'm doing here. And it is bigger than 1, but less than 2. when I say it's bigger than 1 and less than 2, what I mean is this, that if you decide that all the mass is in the energy of the fields, and all the angular momentum is in the field angular momentum, then you find a gyromagnetic ratio whose precise value I forget, but I have worked out, and it's in one of my papers, but I haven't, I could look it up afterwards. But now, this is an interesting question, you see. We've got a charge uniform sphere. Here are the field energies. You work out the thing that's sort of like the fine structure constant, which is the square of the charge divided by twice the angular momentum. I mean, this thing would be h if you were dealing with an electron, times c. You get 9/4. I hope that's the right way up. Yes, it is. And you would maybe like this to be 1 over 137 point something, so it's rather a long way away from there. This is a relevant question. Is that the solution for a conducting spherical shell? And the answer to that is no. And the reason is that if you look at the charge here, it's going round and round and round because the thing is spinning, and it's spinning in a magnetic field formed by the whole configuration. And so there'll be a Lorentz force pushing that down towards the equator. So this, of course, doesn't matter if you're rotating this sphere at a rate that is small compared with C at the equator, but we're going to rotate it fast. That's the idea of being a relativist, okay? You don't say V is small compared with C all the time. And so we ought to do something a bit better than that. And the answer is to the question is no, the magnetic force is unbalanced. Well, the next problem I'm going to talk about is a rotating charge conducting spherical shell, just because it's easier. And if I solved in front of you the rotating charge axisymmetric disk, it would be full of Legendre functions. And it's quite fun. It's actually more exact than the problem that I will solve in front of you. But it's harder in that sense that it's more complicated mathematically. Both inside and inside, we can write this thing, of course, so that these are true. So E theta is continuous across the shell, and you can write down that. And BR has to be continuous. B theta out minus B theta in has to be the surface current density on the shell. And you want the shell to just have a convective current. That is, the current on the shell is just due to the angular velocity of the shell, capital omega. This is a useful parameter because it's dimensionless. And sigma is the surface density of charge on the shell. And you need this, the current density, to be related to the surface density by this. And this is telling you that in the rotating axes, there shouldn't be an electric field within the surface of the shell, so that the surface of the shell has this thing equals zero, because it's a perfect it's a conductor. It doesn't have to be a perfect conductor. A perfect conductor could have any sort of J phi. This is going to be an imperfect conductor, but it's still at equilibrium. It's going to have no electric field inside it. 5 says that the current is due to the moving charge, and 6 says there's no Lorentz force inside the conductor. Well, this is the sort of problem that you did in second or third year university. You can expand everything in Legendre polynomials, and because of its symmetry, it comes out in terms of P2Ns. There are some coefficients here. This makes del squared phi equals naught inside. This makes del squared phi equals naught outside. And these ensure that phi is harmonic and continuous because of the way I've taken them across r equals a. And the jump in d phi dr gives us 4 pi sigma. And we get this expression for the surface density. And now you can do the whole sort of thing again for the magnetic scalar potential. And that has these rather odd properties. It doesn't have to be continuous itself, but its derivative has to be continuous. And so you put in these coefficients to make sure that its derivative is continuous across the shell. And so you then get discontinuity in B theta is this, and that'll give you an expression for J phi. So all that's very standard stuff and is very familiar to all of you. But what you end up with is you end up with relationships between the phi 2n and the chi 2n plus 1, which and it's useful to define this eta, which is slightly easier to work with than chi. I just defined eta because it's useful. And after a bit of work, we find that phi 2n is related to the etas like this. And an interesting coefficient here times eta 2n is the difference between those two. Well, these lead, look at that coefficient for a bit. It's so rather close to one. Not when n is very small, like naught, but when, you know, n plus 3/4 squared is n squared plus 3/2 n plus 3/4 squared, and this thing is n squared plus 3/4 n plus 1/2. And 3/4 squared is not very different from 1/2. And so the difference you can write, combining these two, you get this recurrence relationship here. And this is that same little omega that we talked about before. And this number here, well, it's a lot less than 1 for n greater than 0. If you put n equals 0, this number is an 1/8. If you put n equals 1, it's 1 over 48. N equals 2, it's 1 over 120. And n equals 3, it's 1 over 224. So it wouldn't be a very bad approximation, at least for high order terms in this recurrence relation, to just forget about this. And if you forget about this, this recurrence relation is one of those nice ones in which the coefficients no longer depend on n. Anyone can solve those recurrence relations. So you can actually, apart from the sort of monopole and dipole and quadrupole contributions in all this, you can actually get a solution to this problem by making this approximation and looking at what happens to all the large n coefficients via that relationship, the solution of that recurrence relation. And this is doing that. If you look at the convergence solution, you've got to have the thing that you raise to the nth power less than 1, and that thing turns out to be this coefficient here. And you can then use the exact recurrence relation for monopole up to quadrupole terms. And apart from those corrections, the field outside the sphere, and this is sort of fun, apart from those corrections, the field outside the sphere is as though it came from a magic disk of the smaller radius, not A, the radius of the sphere, but root U A. So although we didn't start with the magic field here at all, as you rotate this thing, it is becoming nearer and nearer the magic field of order A. And in the limit omega equals 1, U tends to 1. And so it's as though you had a magic field that was in a little disk smaller than the sphere. And the little disk grew and grew and grew as omega got closer to 1 until it touched the sphere at R equals A. And then the field outside is just like, apart from those correction terms, it's just like the field of the magic disk. Now, that has taken you through the sort of thing you can do with the sphere. But of course, I have left out things that are very important and fun. If I take a physical sphere and try and rotate it very fast, if I go to the axes rotating with the sphere, in which I think it maybe ought to be still the same shape, perhaps, I don't even know what a sphere is. Because the metric inside a rapidly rotating sphere is not, it's axis symmetrical, but it hasn't, you know, a statement as to what a sphere is in a general metric is not at all clear. And so what I've actually done in this problem is I've cut a spherical hole in flat space, and then I've said that I've got a shell that is rotating, and I'm rotating that shell, whatever it be. And internal to the shell itself, it may not look spherical at all. But I'm not going to worry about that. I'm just going to take the sphere in the non-rotating space. Now, the other thing that's sort of interesting is when I'm calculating the angular momentum or anything like that, the electric field's angular momentum will be exactly calculated from Maxwell's equations from the solution that I've got outside the sphere. Find inside the sphere if it has an internal field. Now, I haven't been taking account of the fact that the charges on this sphere, if they were electrons or something like that, and they had some mass, the mere fact that they were being whirled round and round would push them to the equator as well as the electrical terms. How much of the mass should I put in there? Should I put all the mass of the electrons in there? Or should I say the electrical part I've been treating exactly on the outside because I've taken into account the angular momentum of the field. And part of the electron's mass is due to its field. Well, I've slid under the door all these problems. I've just treated the pure electrical problem, which without worry as to whether the electrons had mass or not. My charges on this problem have no mass. As it were, they are just obeying the electromagnetic equations, and I've said it's a perfect conductor, so that's that. Now, we'll go to the more interesting part of this. If you look at this solution, at an equatorial speed of 93% of the velocity of light, the charge density on the poles becomes zero. We started with a uniform sphere when it was non-rotating. It's gradually getting being pushed down towards the equator. If you go faster than 93%, the polar caps become negatively charged if we've made Q positive. And as we go further and further and further, the amount and area of that negative charge becomes larger and larger. And indeed, if you look at the total charge in the equatorial belt, the belt that has the positive charge, that actually diverges as C is approached. And it diverges like 1 over the square root of the square root of V, 1 minus V squared over C squared. So 1 over the square root of gamma. This angle goes as this angle here above the equator goes, I think it's a third of root 1 minus V squared over C squared. Now, you will see that this is generating, a sort of dipole at the equator, because you've got, sorry, I have to disgorge rather a lot of things from my pocket. But this is what I want. Here you have a cork, which I've made positively charged on the outside, so it's red, and negatively charged on the inside, so it's sort of a mixture between black and blue. And if I take this thing with no total charge at all and do this, then the current due to this outside piece, the red current or positive current, will be exactly the same, since the same charge goes around, as the negative current due to the inside piece. But their magnetic moment will be different because the area swept out by the outer ring is bigger than the area swept out by the inner ring. So as a result of that, there'll be a net dipole moment with no charge, perfectly classically, just by doing that. And of course, if you just add a charge onto that, you can now generate from the dipole you can generate as much magnetic moment as you like. So you can get a gyromagnetic ratio as big as you like by adding a small charge to a dipole. Now, that therefore tells one something about what's going on in this sphere. This sphere has a is generating a negative charge over the top of the sphere and over the bottom of the sphere, and a large positive charge that counteracts it. And you might see that this is somewhat analogous to that magic field that we got. And if we went to the limit, you could see that you got a negative charge distribution that actually went to an infinite negative charge when V equals C, then counteracted suddenly at the very edge by a positive charge. Now, if you want to get more exactly that field, we've said all that. If you want to get more exactly that field, you go to spheroidal coordinates and look at the rotating disk. Again, you can use the, it says field energy. I don't know why that is the field energy, but this is a definition of omega, which is the equatorial velocity divided by c, and that's A times capital omega. And this is the total energy that you get. And this is when little omega is not little omega is equal to 1 when V equals C. But this is just doing the same thing for a rotating conducting disk, which moves the charge. The charge is frozen to the disk, but it, for different velocities, you allow the charge to move radially. And but it always in the equilibrium rotates uniformly with the disk. If you imagine speeding up this disk, with this being the total energy in the electromagnetic field, then you have to put a torque on the disk. So this is the change in the angular momentum is the couple, or the torque, times dt. This will change the energy in the disk by c times omega times dt, because this is the distance moved in the direction of the couple, and that's the couple. Well, this is the angle moved in the direction of the couple, and that's the couple. And you can write all this. And then, believe it or not, you can do this integral. And when you got the right thing, which is this is the integral that you need for the angular momentum, and that comes out in terms of this W, and you can integrate it, and the inverse spline structure constant, as I called it, that is twice LC over Q squared, becomes this complicated factor, which now depends on omega. And if you wanted to get the exact correct number, assuming that only this L is involved, you have to rotate at 0.9970644454 times the velocity of light. But this is numerology. It's not nothing fundamental there at all. That's just saying how much you need to get the right value for the fine structure constant. Now, if you take that omega, and it gives you a certain field energy, and you can demand that L is H over 2, and A is given by the electron's dipole moment, the exact electron's dipole moment. You then get this value of the electron's, of the total energy, total field energy, which is slightly more than MEC squared by this factor. So it looks as though you can quite easily get all the mass of the electron as field energy. It's and it's a bit surprising, but not very surprising, that this factor by which you've got slightly too much energy in the field is sort of interestingly close, let's put it that way, to this factor, which is the correction to the G factor due to quantum electrodynamics. Now, you might have thought that I might have reversed all this and tried to assume the G factor of quantum electrodynamics, or tried to make this exactly one, and then derived a value for the fine structure constant from that statement. However, if I do that, you find that the fine structure constant is 250, or the inverse of the fine structure constant is 252, not 137.035 or 0.037. So I think then that is probably all I have to say. Let's see what the next statement makes. Yes, it's just a repeat of what I said before. I think that it is very silly to go to detailed models of anything to try and get the fine structure constant. And so what I've been saying is probably very silly. And the reason why I say it's very silly is that all charge, no matter what mass you're concerned with, seems to be related. I mean, maybe it should be a third of this for quarks or something, but or three. It seems to me that all charge is quantized in units. We don't really know why it's quantized in units. I still suspect that the answer is simple, despite the fact that many people much cleverer than I have tried to work on this problem. I think it's very important in science to realize that A, oneself, is pretty stupid, and B, that although the others may be quite a lot cleverer, they're pretty stupid too. And at that point, I will stop because it's too controversial to go on. Thank you. Hello.
If you consider there's Lorentz force in a rotating sphere,
yeah,
it could change your sphere a little bit and so it could shape.
I didn't consider the sphere to change shape. I made the sphere a sphere.
You had it with very, very strong, very, very huge. I mean, the Lorentz force is very huge in the weight.
That's right. That's right. In the spherical case, I just made it a sphere all the time. In the disk case, that problem doesn't really occur, but I do need a very, I tried putting a string around the edge of the disk to hold it together, and trying to make that string sort of cosmic string or one of the strings that, I don't know anything about string.
That would decrease your energy.
It changes the energy. I totally agree, it changes the energy. And you go away from G equals 2, which is a pity. So I don't think these are real models of real electrons. I just think it's an amusing subject to talk about. And I am still ambiguous as to whether all the energy in an electron is electromagnetic or not. I do find that working classically on these problems has raised a lot of questions. For instance, if I want to take one of these little disks and say, well, it isn't really a little disk, it's a quantum mechanical object, and I need it to precess in all the way that one does in, if you take something with spin a half or spin one or spin anything, it isn't in a fixed direction like that. It's actually, in the vector model, it's all precessing. The trouble is that I don't know how to do the electrodynamics when this thing is, if I made that a real thing and solved Maxwell's equations for it, then it would make a wave. And I've got to stop that in quantum mechanics. We know even in ordinary atoms, it doesn't make a wave. So, but I actually don't know how to do the elementary mechanics. And a related question is, does anyone here know, which I would love to know, whether there is a decent solution to what I consider one of the simplest problems in quantum gravitation, which is suppose I take a black hole a Kerr black hole, not even a Kerr-Newman black hole, and give it spin a half, can you tell me what the solution ought to be, even for the wave function that is describing the set of metrics over which I should be averaging or something? I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know how to do it because, you know, it would radiate gravitational waves and things. And if anyone knows that, I'd be very glad to hear what I should do, because all those sort of problems, the equivalent things in electrodynamics, come into all these problems too. Does that answer your question to some degree? I can never answer the questions properly. I always go off at a tangent.
So if I turn this around somewhat, you're saying, okay, so it looks like there may be some kind of a relationship here between classical physics and relativity, which ends up having a quantum effect, or you know, there's some kind of linkage between this classical electrodynamics and general relativity and...
Well, even special relativity, maybe, right? Yes.
If you turn it around and you start...
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got the Fourier-Dirac equation and mm-hmm. we've got general relativity, and I want to put these together. Can I invert the problem and recover the classical result? So I've got these three different theories that I want to put together.
Yeah.
I should be able to take any two of them and find the consistency between the third.
Well, I think it's an interesting project. I don't know how to do it, but then I've got, I mean, you know, I'm very elementary in the quantum aspects of things, and I can solve Schrodinger's equation, and I've even solved an n-body Schrodinger equation, which most people never have. I better tell you about that. That's beautiful. If you want an n-body soluble problem, take this potential, V equals any function. It probably better be. Let's make it easy. A over R. But R squared is the sum over pairs of Rij squared. If you want masses, you better have MIMJ. Something like that, when m is the sum of all the masses or something like that. If you look at the n particle Schrodinger equation in these or indeed any function of R, Newton solved the one linear in R. But if you look at all those n-body problems are soluble both in classical mechanics and in classical, that is, non-relativistic quantum mechanics. And I had some fun solving those problems, but I don't think they're much use. Sorry, I've been ignoring you for a time. Thank you.
Sorry, I have one question and one comment.
Fine.
I didn't quite hear the questions which were asked there, so maybe it's related to the question.
Sorry, I didn't repeat questions.
Please correct me if I'm wrong. Do I correctly understand that the point is that if you find the solution, a proper solution of the exclude the gravity, proper solution of electrodynamic equations of motion, you expect to get, like you have some distribution of charges, it produces some field, and in this field, this distribution is like moves appropriately. So it's some consistent solution. Then you expect to get J equals to 2. Then you expect to get G equals to 2, geomagnetic number to be equal to 2.
Not always, only when you're very relativistic.
I have a comment in relation to this question.
Yes.
You see, it's very hard to get in these circumstances that nothing radiates. So you just get radiation. But what gravity does, if you include gravity, it just forbids radiation. Because like if you have a Kerr-Newman black hole, because of the specific features of the horizon, it doesn't radiate.
Sure.
So the gravity just doesn't let this, like it just gives you a solution which is stationary.
I agree. But what was worrying me was the fact that if you take a black hole, and in quantum mechanics, a quantum mechanical black hole, and you give it some angular momentum, the whole metric will precess. And that precession, at least classically, would give you a wave that spread out. Now, in some way, that's got to be forbidden. But in principle, if it's doing this sort of thing, and it's non-spherically symmetric, it will actually give rise to a gravitational wave. And that's not true. I mean, that shouldn't be so for one of these objects. Hello.
A small comment regarding the last slide.
This one?
Yeah.
Okay.
The electromagnetic field is really part of a larger analog
yes.
field.
Yes.
That explains the compensation of charge.
Does it explain it?
Yeah. I mean, because once you're in a non-abelian group, once that U1 is embedded in a non-abelian group, you don't have any more freedom to choose a charge to be whatever you want. Everything that is, all the particles are representations of group.
Yes, I agree.
Once you reduce to the U1s, they come, that U1 is basically just the eigenvalue of the diagonal, and those are discrete version of the.
So they come out discretely.
That's right.
But you don't predict the value of the discreteness.
We don't predict what is E, but you do predict that they're quantized.
Yeah, okay, well that's nice, thank you, I didn't know that much.
No.
You can see I don't know much, but I'm not worried about it, I'm old enough not to worry.
But I mean, this is not just a political, I mean, in the Stan model, the electromagnetism is embedded into an unabelian group.
Yes.
Now, in the Stan model, it actually doesn't explain it all the way, because it's embedded into a group which is itself partially...
embedded into another group, yes.
Abelian group.
But,
you have to have electromagnetic field to be compact, okay? Because if it is embedded. In standard model, it's not explained, the quantization of the charges.
That's what I just said, that it's not
embedded.
It's not embedded. But also, the value itself is a little bit, seems like a little bit of a red herring to try to explain it, because it runs.
I understand that it runs, but you know, until you've got both an explanation of exactly how it runs and why the value that it runs from is that value, you haven't actually explained it.
That's right, but doesn't it seem a little more reasonable to try to explain what is its value at high energies rather than what is its value?
Well, that's a matter of opinion. I mean, I'm of the opinion that it is not very sensible to take the initial conditions of the Big Bang as your basic thing, that's the thing you ought to start from. But I may be wrong in this. I'd prefer to start from things that we know in the current regime, because I'm pretty unsure about exactly what was going on in the conditions at the beginning. But other people take an attitude that, you know, things are complicated now, but, you know, they were very simple at the beginning. And I would like to tell you a story that illustrates this. I succeeded a chap called Professor Redman, who was a Yorkshireman and had a wry sense of humor and was rather a pessimist. And Fred Hoyle had just given a talk at the observatory in which he said, you know, a star is a very simple thing. It's just a ball of gas held up by pressure against its gravity. And you can't have anything very much more simple than that. So stars are basically very simple. And Redman commented, Fred, you would look pretty simple at one parsec. And the point is that Redman had studied the fantastic magnetic phenomena that goes on the outside of the sun, and the granulation, and all the marvelous detail of the spicules and all that. And, you know, Fred wasn't interested in that. Fred saw the big picture, and in some sense, Fred was dead right. Anyway, that's a nice story, so I thought I'd share it with you.
Yeah, on that note, we'll be taking Donald to lunch right now. Then please go if anyone wants to come.